I think it's the wrong idea to think of a single ingredient and say, there's the culprit. It's often the cocktail effect. How are these ingredients all working together? If we weren't looking at single ingredients, we'd go to emulsifiers, of course. Emulsifiers do many jobs. Emulsifiers very often coat the stomach lining. And when they coat the stomach lining, they're not just emulsifying the food, they're emulsifying us. We mustn't accept the accusation that I think you get from the food industry to try to confuse people, say, oh, there's this campaign against processed foods. No, no. The reason for the term ultra-processed is to say, yeah, we know that there's processing. Cooking is processing.
Despite all the headlines, books, and reports about ultra-processed foods, there's still a lot of confusion about what exactly they are and how they make us sick. I actually made a video about the origins of ultra-processed food, and I still came away with so many questions. And the more I spoke to people, the more I saw that lots of other people had lots of questions as well. So I put a call out on the Guardian website to try and collect all the questions people had about ultra-processed foods, and I'm going to put those to a leading expert in the field and try and get them answered for you. Today I'm speaking to Professor Barry Smith, who's the director of the Centre for the Study of the Senses. He's a philosopher and brings in taste and smell with neuroscience and philosophy, and he was once employed by big food companies like Kellogg's and Coca-Cola to try and make their food even more irresistible, but has since left big food altogether and now works to kind of expose how the industry works. Hello, Barry.
Hello.
How are you doing? I love the turtleneck.
Good.
Thank you. Thank you. That's right. I'm going back to my sort of Steve McQueen 1960 look.
Yeah, I like it. I wanted to first ask you, we hear a lot that UPFs are kind of bad for us. We should try and stay away from them. But I think from the kind of questions that we got, there's a lot of confusion. And, you know, for me as well, it's less clear how exactly they make us sick. And I wanted to ask you, is it an immediate short-term thing that's kind of on an ingredient level? Is it a more long-term thing or more of a combination of the two?
I think it's the wrong idea to think of a single ingredient and point the finger at a single ingredient and say, there's the culprit. It's often the cocktail effect. How are these ingredients all working together? Can they be doing something in the combination? So think of when we take sugar out of a soda or out of food, and we replace it with a non-nutritive sweetener, you know, artificial sweetener like aspartame or stevia.
Yeah.
If it's stevia, it may have a slightly nasty, bitter taste. So we'll put another chemical compound in there to mute that. It might be a little cloying, so we'll put a bit more salt in that'll just cut off the cloying aspect. It won't have the volume and the feel of sugar, so we'll put a bulking agent in there. But now that we've put all of those things in there, we might have to stabilize it with another compound. Now we've got an awful lot of chemicals in there. And what are they doing in there? Well, what they're doing is make sure that as near as possible, our experience and our sensory response to those foods is as if of sugar, which we like and we want to go on consuming. But if you were having real sugar and it's going into the body, there'll be a point at which the body says, oh, had enough sugar now, I think I'll stop. But here, you're not stopping because you're getting everything that's like a sugar in the way it tastes, the way it feels in the mouth, but you're not getting the sugar in the body. And other things happen. So you start to store fat because the body feels cheated in not getting those quick sugars inside. So there are bad side effects from a cocktail of ultra-processed ingredients. Don't always look for the single ingredient or the single culprit. If we weren't looking at single ingredients, we'd go to emulsifiers, of course.
I actually wanted to ask you before we get into it. I was eating my like healthy sweet treat earlier, which is chocolate-covered rice cakes. It's like my healthy version of a chocolate bar.
Right.
And I kind of thought that they were UPF free. And then I turned it over today and I was kind of horrified because I saw an emulsifier. But I didn't know if it was like bad. It said soya.
Soya lecithin.
Oh, is that how you say it?
Soya lecithin.
Soya lecithin. Yeah. What's that? That's UPF, right?
That is. It's an extract from soy and it's doing the job of you know, making sure the ingredients that don't usually mix bind together and stay in that emulsified state. If you want foaming agents, if you want a liquid not to separate into the watery and the solid part, if you want a tomato sauce to be glossy, if you want foods to be slippery, Emulsifiers do many jobs, and they do it by one part of the food coating another. But emulsifiers also, very often, like carrageenan and various other things, they will very often coat the stomach lining. And when they coat the stomach lining, they're not just emulsifying the food, they're emulsifying us, and they start to irritate the stomach lining. Now, you have seen an increase of irritable bowel syndrome in people using a high ultra-processed food content diet in the West. And we know from studies, feeding proportionate amounts of emulsifiers to mice, that they develop irritation of the bowel, and they start to actually have ulceration of the stomach lining. So this is a way in which, you know, we're developing conditions in people, perhaps by exposing them to too many of these emulsifiers. And of course, they're in many, many foods. So it's not just having one food with emulsifiers. It might be a huge range of the things that you're eating during the day. You've got these in. The buildup of them could actually be really rather bad, or rather harmful.
Another question we had a lot of was, you know, what exactly are UPFs? So can you kind of tell people what exactly those are, and maybe explain the NOVA classification a bit?
Yes. So, I mean, there's the technical classification in the NOVA system created by Carlos Montero and his colleagues. And that system has whole foods, you know, a whole apple or vegetable, something completely unprocessed at the bottom, nuts and so on. Then you have the first level of minimally processed, and that's where you chop or you grind or you mash or you steam or you boil and so on. Then you've got processed food, where you take some of the results of those ingredients and you start making foods like pasta, and you start making ingredients like cheese, bread. These things are used by taking natural ingredients and then processing them. So we mustn't accept the accusation that I think you get from the food industry to try to confuse people, say, oh, there's this campaign against processed foods. No, no. The reason for the term ultra processed is to say, yeah, we know that there's processing. Cooking is processing. There's a lot of processing that goes on into making foods out of natural ingredients and then refined ingredients. Ultra processing is where it's industrially produced food, adding ingredients designed in the food chemistry lab, usually using things we wouldn't normally eat, to put into the foods to have particular effects and desirable effects. How would we identify them? So there's a rough and ready way that Chris Van Tulleken has suggested, which is, if you see ingredients of things you wouldn't normally find in a domestic kitchen with labels you don't recognize, usually with chemical descriptions to them, and you know the food very often comes wrapped in plastic and carries a spurious health claim, then it's probably ultra-processed.
Yes, absolutely. I think a really good example of that is bread. That was a quick change for me. I was buying exactly this bread, Seed Sensations. I was like, oh, it looks pretty healthy. And then after I read Chris's book, that's when I turned over my bread and I was like, oh, this has 15 ingredients in it.
Right. Right. And they crop up in places you don't expect. So, you know, I was making chili con carne, and I was, you know, getting, I thought, supermarket own brand kidney beans and water. That's what I should expect.
Yeah, but what else?
But then I had a look at the label, and it's got a gelling agent in there to make them look slippery and mulchy and just dry.
Why do they need to look like that?
Because consumers expect it, and they think it will enhance the attractiveness and desirability of them.
Yeah, you know, there's one actually that I still can't find a non-UPF version of, and I love making Thai food and coconut milk.
Yes.
Like, I cannot find a coconut milk that is just coconut milk. This one says it's got the longest word ever in it. It's got coconut extract, 68%, water, and then it says stabilizer polysorbate 60.
Yeah, and polysorbate and then, 60 is one of the worst. Polysorbate 60 is the one that was given to mice where they developed colitis.
Oh. So, Christ,
not good to consume.
And then after that, it says carboxymethyl cellulose.
Carboxymethyl cellulose is also one of the compounds fed to mice where they develop colitis, where they get ulcerative colitis in their gut. So, you know, why would you have that? And what you think is a nice natural ingredient is to use in Thai cooking.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
But if you didn't have really it, nuts. The milk that you have there would come out sort of watery with a thicker part, and they want it just to look continuously smooth all the way through. So it's a sort of aesthetic, and they don't want the consumer to have to do any work.
Yeah, and I feel like as a consumer, if you were given the choice, you can have this coconut milk that has an ingredient that gave mice colitis, or you can have to mix this one.
Yes.
But it's just her whole food.
Right.
Surely everyone's going to go for the mixing one, but it doesn't feel like we were ever given that choice.
The trouble is that the foods are described, at least from the point of selling, by what you expect to find in there. So you say, oh, I'm looking for coconut milk. So this is a can that says coconut milk. That's what I'm expecting in there. If those descriptors were somehow shoved into the name of it, it's coconut milk and emulsifier. So it's coconut milk with carboxymethyl cellulose. You'd say, not sure I want that. So they're very hidden. And I'm sure you've noticed, I'm sure, you know, listeners and viewers will have noticed that the writing of those additional ingredients is so tiny, so tiny. Yeah. Even when you're peering at it, you think, what is that? And the idea is to try to mask it. And a clever thing that's happening now with the attempted clean labeling is to re-describe some of those ingredients. So, natural flavorings. Now, they're flavorings.
I've seen that a lot, natural flavorings.
Natural flavorings. And they're allowed to say that as long as they have ultra-processed a natural ingredient, because they've created a flavoring, but from a natural source. So this is a sort of slightly naughty attempt at clean labeling.
It's becoming even harder to check, even if you are looking at the ingredients labels.
Right.
And on that, kind of looking at the, you know, the sugary content of drinks and like foods generally, it kind of makes me wonder, when it comes to sugar, why load it with so much sugar when surely it'd be cheaper for companies to just put less in?
Right. So there's a good and a sort of slightly worrying aspect to that, which is, yes, let's put less sugar in, and people, you know, it'd be cheaper and they'd still enjoy it. But actually, it's when the body consumes lots of sugar and starts to depend on that volume of sugar and crave it that you'll get repeat sales. So, for example, if you've got a fizzy soda, fizzy sodas that we know, Coke, Pepsi, all of those, Sprite, they're fine when they're cold and fizzy, but if you let them go flat and warm, they're unpalatable.
Yeah.
You try sipping them and you say, too sweet. Now that's good. Your natural self-regulation intake mechanisms are telling you you don't want something with that much sugar. But when you carbonate it, so it's bubbly, and you chill it, that suppresses sweetness and accentuates sourness and makes that amount of sugar palatable. Now that means you get past you as the sensor, your mouth and your palate say, oh, it's not too sweet, it's fine. Meanwhile, your body gets that huge sugar rush and says, ooh, more of that. And you then start craving that amount of sugar. So the system that would have protected you is bypassed by using particular ways of processing that liquid to allow you to ingest a can with 7 heaped teaspoonfuls of sugar. Fructose corn syrup, really sweet.
So sneaky. And like, I think when you look at these foods that have all this, you know, high fructose corn syrup and all of these ingredients, it's usually the cheaper foods. Can you talk a bit how UPF companies are targeting people with the least time and money?
Yes. Yeah. I think this is what's so unfair. I mean, again, remember, food companies in the early days thought, we're doing a good thing. We're making food that is cheap, therefore affordable, plentifully available, you know, on the supermarket shelves, and safe to eat, and it's delicious. What could be better? But realizing that you can offer people non-nutritious or much less nutritious food, and foods that just load them with carbohydrates or sugars, and less of the of the fibers and less of the ingredients that would help them regulate and use those products well, healthily. They're cheap. They're cheap to produce because you're doing this massive pulping of ingredients to extract. You know, instead of going and getting sugar cane, you've got corn, and you're turning corn into sugar, and you're getting these, you know, corn syrups out of it by heavy industrial processing. It's very, very cheap. Pack it in there, and then people think, you know, it's delicious. And I do get that it's very difficult for people. You know, they're hungry, and this food is both desirable to eat and cheap. So people on lower incomes will consume a lot of it, and it's marketed at them to consume a lot of it. You know, the advertising in places like Greg's is, you know, when you've had a sausage roll, why did I just buy one? You know, is the suggestion. Or they even say in their advertising that the front door is nearer than the oven door. So, you know, get it delivered and just consume. So they're asking people to consume this fat, salt, sugary food and consume it quickly and want more of it. And the trouble is, it actually leaves you feeling hungry. It's part of the process of driving the craving for that food, that when you're eating ultra-processed food, you ingest it too quickly. Your body doesn't get a chance to say, I'm full, I've had enough. In a way, it's making people on lower income spend more by buying more of that food instead of being satisfied with, you know, one portion of things, to try to get them to have another portion or to eat more or buy two of a fatty, savory snack or a sugary snack rather than just buy one. So it's not in the end, I think, a saving.
Yeah, it really is. And it really doesn't have to be like that. Like, I'm looking at something about Singapore at the moment. Over there, and in many other countries as well, more unhealthy food is not the cheaper option. It feels like that's the only way, but actually that's not the case, is it? What kind of examples are there of places doing this well, and what are the kind of solutions to this?
What I want to see, though, is the food industry, because we can't do without the food industry. It's massive in feeding people. Cleaning up its act, trying to think its way around this, trying to think of how to make foods better while still making them affordable. Or if we're going to, you know, for example, there's the claim that if you tax or put, you know, like the sugar tax, if you tax these foods, you're penalizing a lot of people on low incomes and poor people who can't afford to, you know, to buy food better. Well, then you've got to use those tax subsidies to subsidize healthy food and have campaigns to try to recommend and encourage people to eat healthy food. Mm. But again, healthy food, it's flavor first. You've got to make it tasty and desirable. These guys have done a very good job at making these foods very, very, you know, Moorish. And Moorish is a nice word. It doesn't sound like addiction, right? But, you know, what is it trying to get you to do, to say, I want more, I can't stop eating these? You know, once you pop, you can't stop. It's right there in the description. So, you know.
Yeah, that's crazy. I think we had a lot of people, and I'm sure as people learn more and listen, they're going to think, well, why can't we just ban these ingredients? Why can't we ban ultra-processed foods? What would you say to that?
What's going on, I think, in the, you know, should we ban it, is the food industry are arguing the ultra-processed food definition in NOVA classification for the highest level of processing, ultra-processed food, it's too complicated a definition. We don't understand it. What's the food industry doing? It's saying, don't use that definition. Far too complicated. Mm. Let's use high fat, salt, and sugar. Now, if we use high fat, salt, and sugar, we can then reformulate the food to lower the fat, the salt, or the sugar, and they use a nutrient profiling model. So there's a scoring system. You get, you know, good points for natural, healthy ingredients and fruit and nuts and so on, you know, tick, 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 tick. But then for any of the, you know, the less healthy ingredients with more fat, more sugar, you know, you get minuses, and then you add up a score. And you're above or below the line for whether this is something that should carry a health warning and we should worry about. But if you think of it, it's such a silly system, because take a bar of Cadbury's Dairy Milk, you know, that might come out as very high in you know, fat and sugar, but then you just add fruit and nuts to it, Cadbury's fruit and nut, and now it's got a much better score. Got more ticks, because you're not eating the chocolate, right? I mean, you're eating the chocolate too. So I worry that what they're going to do is they're going to say, allow us to reduce the salt, fat, and sugar. How are we going to do that? We're going to use lots of ultra-processed ingredients as substitutes. So it's not good enough to say we'll reformulate and change the salt, fat, and sugar if it means we can still put lots of ultra-processed ingredients in there. So they know they can, and that's what they want to do. Here's an analogy. Back in the day in the tobacco industry, we knew there were two problems. There was nicotine and tar. And of course, tar was bad for us, bad for our lungs. So the tobacco industry said, oh, we understand, we hear you. Let us reduce the tar. Let's have low tar cigarettes. Well, if you allow us to do that. So they went for low tar cigarettes because they knew the nicotine was still addictive. So even if they'd
still have their customers.
They would still have their customers. They'd smoke as many, or they would just keep smoking. So we're a bit like that. You can reduce the salt, fat, and sugar, but if you've got the ultra-processed ingredients that make these foods irresistible and we crave them, they'll still sell as much of the stuff.
Mm, and I guess that comes into labeling.
Yes.
We had a lot of questions about labeling. If they manage to sort that out, then it could help inform consumers with labels on the food. Is that something that could happen or is happening anywhere?
Well, right. I mean, in Chile and in Colombia, there is the use of labeling and putting big black octagons on the side, 1, 2, 3, you know, to say how much ultra-processed ingredient is in this product and to be a warning. And what they found was it did change behavior, and it changed behavior in supermarkets in that the young kids would say to their parents, don't buy that, it's not good for you. And the kids were influenced by that instead of being influenced by marketing campaigns to put cartoon characters on the side of ultra-processed food or you know, to make them bright and attractive. So this, you can advertise and market well by using labeling. And I think that should be encouraged.
Yeah, definitely. That's powerful. It's easy to be like, to feel like, because it's big food and the industry and the money's there, that'll never get approved. But it's nice to hear that that is happening.
Yeah.
And there is someone kind of holding UPF companies to account in America, isn't there?
Yes.
With the court case. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. So this is very interesting because this court case has gone after all the big food companies, you know, General Mills, Kellogg's, Kraft, all of them. And it's a young man who has taken these companies to task and bringing a case against them for having developed fatty liver disease so early in his life as a teenager. And fatty liver disease you might see in older people, but now to see the prevalence of it in younger people, that's unusual. And the medics are saying, why is this happening? Well, if you look at the foods that he was regularly eating and which were marketed at him, promoted at him as foods that were enjoyable, delicious, you know, sometimes they say, you know, that they're good for you. This is what he's worried about. And the law firm have put together a really rather tough case. So this is the first time they've all been taken, all the big players have been taken on in an action like this. And indeed, if they make a dent in them, there'll be a class action of people saying, yes, my health suffered. I had disease and disease-related diabetes and obesity as a result of eating these products. And these products were marketed at me and I was never told that they could be bad for me. They'd have these adverse effects. So it's a very important case, a very important case.
Yes, I hope so too. And, you know, for people listening to all this, you know, it's a lot of information about ultra-processed food. I suppose for people who listen to this want to reduce their intake of ultra-processed food, maybe on a budget, haven't got that much time, what's one thing you'd kind of recommend to them?
Well, I think, first of all, identifying it, that's the main thing. Try staying off it. I stayed off it and I noticed the benefits to me very quickly. If you can stay off it for a week, better 2 weeks. And at first you might think, oh, you know, I miss or I crave those foods. Eventually, when you've stayed off ultra-processed food, as I say, you won't be as tired. You won't be hungry all the time. And when you go back to eating it, the food will seem too kind of intense. It doesn't taste like food. It tastes like some sort of artificial stimulant. Stay off it. And you'll find that you take more pleasure and interest in other foods. You'll start eating fruits, start eating an apple and thinking, oh, this is really rather delicious. Meat's expensive, and we shouldn't eat as much of it as we do, I guess, because of the planet. But if you're going to make vegetables interesting, there are things to do, like roasting them, like pickling them. How do we eat for pleasure and the planet, as my friend and collaborator Ollie Muritzen says? And the answer is umamify vegetables, add umami, that fifth taste, that savory deliciousness.
Yes. Barry, I think we need a recipe book from you next.
I'm working.
Next project. Thank you so much for your time. This has been such an interesting conversation, as always.
Thank you. Great to talk to you. Thanks very much.